The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, we'll head down to the coast with excerpts from Chapter 5 of Alton Balance's book, Okra Cokers. A Day Hunting on the Reef. When I was growing up on Ocracoke, most of my free time was spent fishing, playing basketball, or hunting. While the busy summers were filled with mulleting, swimming, and getting to know some of the summer people, the lonely winters were passed playing basketball and hunting birds, ducks, and geese. Like other Ocracoke boys, my interest in hunting began when I was given my first BB gun. In addition to shooting at makeshift targets, we also tramped all over the village in search of birds, especially robins and cedar waxwings. Although the idea now seems a little atrocious, we actually killed and ate scores of these birds. Eventually, we outgrew BB guns and began to take an interest in shotguns. Most of the boys had been hunting with their fathers, and they were eager for their 16th birthday, which meant a hunting license and gun of their own. My father didn't hunt, but I sometimes got to go hunting with Fowler O'Neill and his son Bobby. Bobby and I spent many hours together, not only mulleting, but also hunting birds, ducks, and geese. Many mornings and afternoons we would scout the creeks and shorelines of the village for any ducks and geese that might have strayed inshore. Fowler O'Neill is a stocky man of medium height with a full head of ash-colored hair. He retired on disability from the North Carolina Department of Transportation, Ferry Division, where he worked as a quartermaster on one of the Ocracoke Cedar Island ferries. His retirement came about after two heart attacks, the first while he was fishing shad nets several miles offshore in Pamlico Sound. He says that he's lucky to be alive, especially after that day so far out on the water, alone, when he had to steer the boat almost an hour in rough winter water, with increasing pains running throughout his chest and arms. After his retirement, Fowler was able to spend more time doing the things he enjoys the most, fishing gill nets and hunting. I've never been much of a hunter, although it is difficult to believe, given my early interest in the sport. When I finally got old enough to buy my hunting license, I had lost interest in hunting. I go out with Fowler occasionally, but only to observe. We went out one morning when conditions were promising. "You couldn't ask for a better hunting day," said Fowler. After a week of clear, warm weather, perfect for tourists but lousy for hunting, the wind had shifted from the southwest to the northwest, increasing steadily throughout the night to approximately 20 knots, and the sky had thickened to a heavy gray overcast. Early that morning we left the creek in Fowler's boat, a sharp-looking skiff powered by a 25-horsepower Evinrude outboard motor. Bobby called the skiff the Shark because of its slender appearance and the way it shot through the water when the power was increased. I sat near the stern as Fowler steered from the bow with a stick connected with cables that ran to the stern and the motor. The waves slapped against the port side of the boat, and cold spray pelted us as we headed toward Howard's Reef. Bobby had told me that his father's blind was located on the back edge of Eastern Bight, and added that I wouldn't mistake it for any other blind, since it was the tallest blind on the reef. I knew exactly which blind was his. We often fished for mullets there during the warmer seasons. After the cold trip across the channel, Fowler slowed the motor as we approached a short stake that stuck up out of the water along the edge of the reef. We would tie the boat to this stake and wade to the blind, located almost a quarter of a mile away on the back edge of the reef. When the boat had been secured to the stake and the anchor thrown overboard, we tightened the straps on our waders and began walking toward the blind. I offered to take some of the gear, but Fowler insisted on taking all of it. Slung over his shoulders and dangling from his arms were two decoys, one a goose, the other a duck, an oilskin coat, a 12-gauge shotgun, and a small, as he said, star foam, cooler containing binoculars, several boxes of shotgun shells, and a lunch consisting of sandwiches, crackers, Pepsi, and candy. Near the boat, the water was waist-deep, but as we walked up on the reef further, it shallowed to our knees. The strong northwester had spread an unusually high tide, and tiny whitecaps slapped up against our boots as we walked. The winter reef looked cold, gray, and lifeless, and felt quite a bit different from the way I remembered it from my summer mulleting expeditions. As we approached the blind, I could see that Bobby had been right when he said it was the tallest blind on the reef. While the others measured about 9 feet from the waterline to the top of the blind, Fowler's measured at least 12 feet. It was more like a small watchtower than a duck blind. The legs of the blind were 6-inch round creosote poles, each buried with a slight inward tilt for greater stability and support. Barnacles, oysters, and other aquatic growth covered the underwater portions of the legs. Nailed between two poles were 4 2x4s used as a ladder. The climb seemed rather steep to me, especially for a man who had heart trouble. While I was pondering over this potential hazard, Fowler began to climb up the ladder, pulling himself up with one hand and holding the gun in the cooler with the other. When he reached the entrance of the blind, he set aside the gear near the door, entered the blind, and began tossing the decoys down into the water. Bobby had told me, "Wait till you see his stand of decoys." The collection of decoys, which included geese, brant, and ducks, looked like a pretty sick bunch of birds. Out of the whole flock of about 25, maybe 2 could pass for attractive decoys. Several of the geese had their heads broken or shot off. The neck of one was plugged with a crooked stick, painted black with the bill turned toward the tail. A number of the others had been repainted with colors resembling the original blacks, grays, browns, and whites. There were also 2 styrofoam crab pot buoys, each with a blade of plywood wedged in the top to resemble the tail feathers. When Fowler had thrown the last decoy from the blind, he climbed back down the ladder to spread them in an arc several yards northwest of the blind. Each of the decoys was strung with about 2 yards of 1/8-inch nylon cord, one end tied to the decoy and the other to a small lead anchor. I climbed up the ladder and stood in front of the door. Fowler shouted from below that I should get in the blind and sit down. I pulled aside the small door and entered. The blind itself was a patchwork structure made from second-use, nail-ridden 2x4s and pieces of plywood salvaged from scrap lumber piles and other dilapidated blinds. The 2x4s served as the framework onto which the plywood was nailed. The entire house was 4 feet square and about 5 feet high. Fowler again yelled for me to make myself comfortable on the seat, a 2x6 placed on braces at either end of the blind. It had been a long, cold walk from the boat, and as I positioned myself on the seat, I felt more comfortable and just a little excited and expectant. Looking up, I noticed the 1-inch peep crack that had been left along the sides of the blind, which allowed hunters a strategic view, half of the water, half of the horizon. We would spend a great amount of time looking through this crack. Standing up, I found the top edge of the blind level with my shoulders. It sure was an excellent view, and I could see why Fowler was proud of his towering structure. In the water below, he spaced the last decoy, then started to wade back toward the blind. "That's a stand for you, ain't it?" he said, referring to the flock of decoys that rode the small waves with firm, inanimate resistance. As he approached the blind, I could hear him laughing, amused at his decoys. I sat back down and slipped over to the left to make room for Fowler as he entered the blind. He slid the door back in place and pulled off his oilskin coat. Before sitting down, he picked up his shotgun and unsheathed it from its plastic-insulated case. He then rummaged through the cooler until he came out with a handful of shotgun shells. He placed one shell in the chamber of the gun, gave the pump handle a quick slick-slack, and then inserted 2 more shells. After putting the gun in a corner, Fowler sat down, repositioning himself several times before getting comfortable. "I've got 2 blinds here on this reef," he said. "I reckon they've been here for 15 years or more. Of course, I've rebuilt them year after year when they've needed it, but I've been using the same location for a good while. This blind is a sturdy one. I don't expect she'll go anywhere. Sometimes the blinds get torn up during hard blows, hurricanes, and such as that, But you've got to come out during the first of the season anyway to check on them and rebuild them if they need it. The wall facing us was partially constructed from an old sign that Fowler had found washed up along the shore. The faded letters had once been part of a sign advertising cottages for rent. "I have another blind back there along the inside edge of the reef," he continued, pointing his thumb over his left shoulder. "I hunt there sometimes when the weather's mild. It seems that on the mild days the fowl tend to fly along the inside edge. When it's bad and blowing like today, it's better along the back edge of the reef, near the sound. That's why we came here, because I think that some fowl might be following this back edge down." We continued talking, all the while scanning the horizon through the crack. Fowler took out his binoculars and spotted a large flock of geese about a half mile north, only several hundred yards from another hunter's blind. At the time, no one occupied it. We sat almost nervously, anticipating something flying within range. Occasionally we spotted dark objects that, upon closer inspection, proved to be cormorants. It always seemed that there were thousands upon thousands of these water birds, flying in endless strings, the first to arrive, the last to leave. Even though the birds are fish eaters, some ocracokers eat them. One resident said, "Take the breast and fry it, and there's nothing better, just as good as any steak." From a distance, they often fool even the best hunter into thinking that a goose or duck is on the way. I got into the habit of whispering, "What's that?" when I spotted anything that threatened to fly into range. Eventually, we both began to whisper, thinking that even over the howl of the northwester, the ducks and geese might hear us if we talked too loudly. We had been sitting there no more than an hour when I spotted the white flash of color on several pintails. They appeared suddenly overhead and just to the north of the blind. Fowler was looking far over to his right at a large flock of geese. I blurted out several "What's that's?" and he responded with several "Where's?" Before I could say anything else, he had sensed the location of the pintails and jumped up quickly to his feet, pulling the gun to his shoulder and firing three quick shots at the ducks. For all his quickness on the draw, though, he had missed. The pintails were out of range by the time the shots were fired. "If I'd seen them a few seconds earlier, we might have had a pair of springtail now," said Fowler, referring to the pintails by a name local hunters use. The noise of the shot resounding through the blind and the sharp smell of gunpowder gave the feeling that something momentarily powerful had taken place. At least there had been a shot, and this gave us hope that more fowl would fly our way. Fowler took up his binoculars again and looked at the large flock of geese. "Boy, I'd like to get a shot at them," he said. "I know there'll be some springtail around today, maybe some other ducks, but I don't know so much about that flock of geese. You see, you've got a problem when you're out here hunting by yourself. It's better if different ones are hunting all along the reef and inshore. That way they keep 'em runned up and flying around, and there's a better chance of getting some good shots." Settling down again after the first shots of the day, Fowler continued, commenting on the present hunting season. "I believe there have been more fowl flying around the first part of this season than since I was a boy. For a while there was flock after flock of springtail, widgeons, and even a good sign of brant and geese. You can't kill brant this particular season, even though there are a lot of them around here. They're pretty dumb birds and easy to kill. I reckon that's one of the reasons, but I think it has more to do with their migration patterns and the fact that the people who are setting the laws want to try to build up their numbers." Although the waterfowl today are fewer in number and the daily limits are becoming more restrictive, there was a time when a reasonable income could be made from killing and selling ducks and geese. Thurston Gaskill, Sr., who has spent most of his life in the fishing and hunting guide business, well remembers the market hunting times before Congress passed the Migratory Bird Act during the 1917-18 hunting season. This act outlawed the killing of large numbers of ducks and geese. "In my early years as a boy," recalled Thurston, "I remember that my father used to depend on market hunting for part of his living. Along with other men to the island, he used to go out on the reefs, most of the time over near Beacon Island and Portsmouth Island, and kill numbers of geese and ducks. Sometimes they used rolling blinds. They were something on the order of the regular duck blinds, but they had rollers on the bottom, so you could roll the whole blind up to a flock of fowl. It was not uncommon for him to shoot 500 to 700 shells per week. Back in those days, they had plenty to shoot at, however, and their kill would often be in the hundreds. They would come back in the village, usually with the boat loaded, then sell the birds to Captain Will Willis or some other merchant operating at that time, who would in turn transport them to New Bern or Morehead City. They packed the flour in flour barrels, and I believe they were paid by the barrel. My father used to make as high as $100 per day, and of course, that was good money in those days. It wasn't long before people began to realize that too many ducks and geese were being killed, and that there would soon have to be a limit set. The winter of 1917-18 was the last winter that you could kill and sell migratory fowl. That put an end to the market hunting. The first limit was 8 geese, 8 brant, and 25 ducks per day. Compare that to the 1 goose and several ducks you're allowed today, and you'll get an idea of how the limit has gradually decreased each year. Even though the end of market hunting eliminated a source of revenue and angered the hunters, they were aware that such freedom with the trigger couldn't last. Several men had already begun practicing another way of making a living during the winter, serving as a hunting guide. "During the market hunting times," continued Thurston, "my father and other men of the island also took hunters out and served as a guide for them. He had this camp built over on the southern end of Beacon Island, and used to take hunters over there to stay periods of time. My father seemed to make the adjustment from market hunting to hunting parties pretty easily. Serving as a hunting guide was a more dependable income. After I got out of the Navy, I started to build up a fishing and hunting guide business myself. For a while, hunting wasn't so good because of the disappearance of the eelgrass. I believe it covered about a 10-year period. Anyway, this was prime food for the waterfowl, and they simply migrated where the grass could be found. Some of the grass eventually came back, and hunting also improved." My grandfather, Elisha Balance, recalled when geese were so plentiful that their honking would keep people awake all night. He also said that on several occasions he shot geese on moonlit nights from his backyard. As the morning flew by, and time did fly, not miserably creep along as I had thought it would, it appeared that the thick cloud cover of early morning might break. Far out in the northwest, over the middle of Pamlico Sound, long reddish cracks lined the horizon. Fowler and I turned to watch several boats speeding up the channel toward us. One boat was a small wooden craft, and the other was a new 20-foot fiberglass Pioneer with a 55-horsepower motor. While we talked and scanned the horizon through the crack, the two boats pulled up to the edge of the reef not far from Fowler's boat, and the hunters got out and began walking to their blinds. The man in the wooden boat was older. He continued wading until he reached a stake stuck in the middle of the reef. He then tied his skiff there and walked several hundred yards to his blind. The fiberglass boat held 2 younger men. They tied their boat to a stake along the inside edge of the reef. Their blind was also along that side of the reef and close to Fowler's other blind. Fowler soon spotted several more pintail. His head moved continuously from side to side and up and down to keep sight of the fast-moving ducks. I kept still and could feel his body get tense, see his hand tighten its grip on the pump handle as the third finger on his right hand pushed in the safety of the gun. Within the next moment, a pair of quite different sounds that often occur together could be heard, the airy sound of wings beating and the whistle-like call of the pintail, followed by the sudden booming of 3 quick shots from a gun. But, once again, the ducks had flared upward at the crucial moment, over the blind, out of range, and Fowler had missed. Sinking down on the seat, Fowler said, "Talk about a bum shot. That's all you can call it, a bum shot. You don't want to tell Bobby about that one." I told him it seemed to me that the pintail had never gotten close enough, that they were out of shot range. He laughed and said, "Yeah, bum shot." The cloud cover had loosened gradually, pushing to the southeast in thin white patches of vapor. Through these clouds, clear blue sky could be seen. As much as we both hoped against it, the day was going to turn out to be beautiful after all. The harsh sound of a jet, probably out of Cherry Point Marine Corps Air Station, some 60 miles away, broke through the ordinary sounds of wind and lapping water. Fowler and I watched the jet as it raced by, flying on a course that included the reef. "These jets help you out sometimes," he said. "It scares the fowl, and they fly up and move around." As he predicted, a large flock of geese, perhaps a mile and a half inshore, taking advantage of the big tides that made feeding along the marsh bank profitable, rose up and began to fly, slowly and majestically, in our direction. About half of the flock soon settled back down, while the other half suddenly veered to the left and continued on a southward course, flying along the edge of the island. We both strained to keep sight of them in the glare of the bright new sun reflecting off the water. Trailing behind them were four that refused to follow the larger flock, and instead headed directly toward the reef, and more or less toward us. We continued watching, attentive to the direction of their flight path. When they began flying parallel to the inside edge of the reef, only 100 yards or so from Fowler's boat, and very near his other blind, it was time for him to take out his goose call. He blew out several loud honks, hoping that the geese would hear it and turn our way. The geese soon halted their sluggish flapping and began gliding on a descending slant until they splashed into the shallow water. "Look at that, won't you?" Fowler said. "Now there's something pretty, especially when they start falling like that." The geese had fallen only yards from the other blind on the inside edge of the reef. "This weather's starting to clear now," he continued, "and the wind seems to be falling out some. If we were there in that other blind, we'd have a goose by now." But we weren't in the other blind, and all we could do was watch. At first it appeared there might be a chance of the geese drifting toward us, but it wasn't long before they saw the larger flock, about 400 yards to the south, that we had spotted earlier. As the four geese started to swim toward the others, Fowler said, "You got a problem, you know, when different people are not scattered all along the reef hunting." During the next half hour we talked, ate sandwiches and candy, and occasionally checked on the other hunters in the blinds to the north and east of us. They had not even fired their guns. It was now about 2 o'clock, and Fowler asked if I was tired, and said that any time I wanted to go, he would be ready. I think we both saw them, but still I said, "What's that?" pointing north at another group of ducks. From a distance, we could both tell that they weren't pintail. Nothing appeared white on these ducks, and they were flying slower. But they were headed directly for the blind. Fowler readied his gun. "Boy, talk about pretty," he whispered. "Ain't that something pretty? They're headed right this way." For the next half minute, the ducks continued our way. As they got closer, Fowler identified them as widgeons. From one moment to the next, they had disappeared from our crack view and flashed visible in the open sky over the blind. They were high, and I thought that Fowler didn't have much of a chance at hitting any of them. While I was thinking this, he jumped up and fired 3 times. I then stood up alongside him to see if he had hit any. About 4 or 5 fluffy white feathers glided downward gently. "I hit one of them," he said excitedly. There were 3 of them, and 2 had flown ahead of the third. It was the third one that he had been hit. "Watch him fall, watch him fall," said Fowler quickly. Just as he had said, the widgeon began a downward glide, almost as if it were settling down to rest or feed. It didn't seem to me that the duck had been wounded bad enough to fall. Fowler didn't waste any time getting out of the blind and scrambling down the ladder. The widgeon had fallen about 200 yards westward. Fowler would have a good walk, and it was quite possible that the duck might get up and fly again, or simply swim away. The widgeon stayed within several yards of where it had fallen, however, and Fowler gained on it fast, trudging through the cold water like a marine during a beach landing. The 2 other widgeons circled back, almost as if to check on their wounded companion. I yelled to Fowler and tried to point them out, but he did not hear. All his concentration was focused on the downed bird, ready to react should it try to escape. The 2 other widgeons then flared off toward the back of the reef and were gone, leaving their triplet to the mercy of the approaching hunter. By then Fowler was within shot range, but he refused to shoot. He was trying to get close enough to grab the duck, and several times he came close, but it flew out of range. He didn't want to risk tearing up the body with another shot. The little dodge game continued another several minutes before the duck gradually gave up. Fowler finally got close enough so that his shadow cast down over the doomed duck. He then reached down and grasped the flapping creature by the neck. With 6 or 7 rotations, the neck was wrung. Fowler began walking back toward the blind, taking his time, obviously pleased with his first kill of the day. When he reached the blind, he stood in front of the ladder before climbing up and threw the widgeon through the door. It banged lightly against a wall and lay limp on the floor. Aside from a few ruffled feathers, nothing showed that it had been shot. This widgeon was a hen, mostly brown with speckles of black and white. Climbing the ladder, Fowler was laughing again. "Yeah, you want to be sure to tell Bobby about that shot. You want to tell him that you've seen a lot of shots in your day, but nothing to match this one. Be sure to tell him how far away he fell from here after I hit him. I had no idea that they were close enough. Why, some of the sprigtail that I missed a while ago were a lot closer than that. Let him have it anyways." Fowler was restless after this shot. Perhaps he now considered the day successful after killing something. Bobby had said that his limit was one duck per day. The restlessness turned to mild foolery as he stood up and began picking the duck. The wind had backened up from the northwest to a more westerly direction, and that would cause the feathers to drift downward toward the young hunters in the blind along the inside edge of the reef. "I want to let Terry know that I got something," he said. Within a few minutes there was a line of feathers adrift on the water toward their blind. Two heads appeared over the top of the blind, looked our way for several seconds, then disappeared. The older man in the other blind was out and had started collecting his decoys. He had not fired his gun. Except for a line of white clouds on the eastern horizon, the whole sky was clear and blue. We stood up, more relaxed and less concerned about being seen. With our arms resting on the top edge of the blind, we looked around us. There were a few ducks flying around here and there, but it really didn't seem to matter much. After a few moments of silence, Fowler spoke, this time with a more serious tone. "You know, it's peaceful out here. I've been doing this stuff ever since I was a boy. I love it, though, and I reckon I've been out here more lately since I retired than I have in years. It's pretty some out here. You get your peace of mind, you know. It's good just to get away from home. Yeah, good to get out of the house with all the phones ringing, television, record players, and all that mess that we didn't have when I was growing up. Things have changed around home a lot, but as long as I can get out here, I think I'll be all right." After a few moments of silence, as if he had made up his mind right then, Fowler said, "Well, let's get out of here. We could stay longer and maybe get another shot, but I don't think that'll be worth it." He told me to stay in the blind, and he would toss up the decoys. When he had collected the decoys, dragging them along behind him by their nylon cords, he came up to the blind. All I could think of was that he looked like some kind of wild bird himself, towing his young chicks behind him. The flock all stored away, and the blind door pulled by. We left and waded back toward the boat. The whole reef looked different now, almost like summer. Fowler had no doubt that the weatherman was going to be right in his forecast for a beautiful weekend. That didn't matter too much to him. He would still go out, even if he had to sit in the blind all day and watch the reef as the day passed before him. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast on our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.